From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Barry Tuckwell is considered one of the best French horn players in the world, and even he considers the horn a treacherous instrument. On this edition of Fresh Air, Tuckwell discusses the horn and his other career as a conductor. Also today, veteran journalist Otto Friedrich tells us when a fact is irrelevant. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of music from tenor saxophonist Albert Eiler, and book critic John Leonard reviews Frank Zappa's new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. President Bush is in Washington today meeting with top aides and congressional leaders following a claim by a pro-Iranian Muslim group that it executed Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins. The president said he is still trying to confirm whether the body seen on a videotape hanging by the neck is that of Higgins. The Hezbollah faction said it hanged Higgins in retaliation for Israel's abduction of a Muslim cleric. Hours later, a second Hezbollah faction threatened to kill another American by tomorrow night unless Sheikh Abdul Obeid is freed. More from Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
So long as Israel holds the Sheikh, the kidnapped group seem to believe they'll get what they want, worldwide publicity. Hours after one group announced it had hanged Higgins, a second said it would kill another American, Joseph Sosipio. His execution, insisted the Revolutionary Justice Organization, will be watched on screens around the world. This chilling statement was obviously in response to the considerable media attention that the colonel's supposed execution had generated. But there was no way of telling when a videotape released tonight of his body dangling from a rope was recorded, and there are many reports that Higgins was killed a long time ago. Now, the major fear here is that kidnap groups have realized they have the upper hand, and by threatening more executions, they'll gain more attention. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
Congressional investigators now believe that a former top federal housing official who refused to testify lied to Congress under oath 2 years ago. Representatives Tom Lantos and Charles Schumer both discussed the August 1987 testimony of Deborah Gore Dean. As executive assistant to then-Secretary Samuel Pierce, Dean held wide but unofficial authority at HUD. Forest and rangeland fires are burning in several western states. The most severe blazes are concentrated in eastern Oregon and Idaho, where more than 6,000 firefighters are on the line. Alan Saporn of member station KLCC has more.
Lightning strikes touched off more than 100 blazes in eastern Oregon alone. In Oregon and Idaho, 19 blazes are currently classified as major fires, with nearly 100,000 acres burned. BLM Information Officer Debbie Shivers says steep terrain in some places complicates the firefighting, but she says the weather is the biggest problem.
Strong winds, low humidities, and high temperatures make it, you know, almost impossible to get a handle on those fires.
Yesterday, one fast-moving blaze whipped by gusting winds forced ranchers near Baker, Oregon, to flee their homes and turn livestock loose. The danger there is over, but other evacuations remain in effect in Oregon and Idaho. There have been no reports of injuries. Dozens of homes, mobile homes, and outbuildings have been destroyed. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Saporin reporting.
Stock prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 25 points. This is NPR News. Residents on the Texas and Louisiana coast braced for heavy weather today as forecasters predict the season's first hurricane would strike land within 24 hours. Hurricane Chantal formed in the Gulf of Mexico and was declared a Category 1 or minimal hurricane late this afternoon. The Energy Department says it may have to spend more than $72 billion over the next 5 years to begin the cleanup of the nation's nuclear weapons production plants. Energy Secretary James Watkins is expected to provide a blueprint of the 5-year cleanup program in a speech before the National Press Club tomorrow. Foreign ministers from some 19 nations have reported some progress in talks in Paris on the future of Cambodia. Kathleen Hunt reports there is some apparent agreement on broad issues of monitoring the Vietnamese troop withdrawal and preventing the Khmer Rouge from seizing power.
Vietnamese Foreign Minister Nguyen Co Thuc likened the former Cambodian regime of Pol Pot to the fascist regimes of Germany and Italy and called for it to be eradicated indefinitely. The Khmer Rouge, which is a member of Prince Sihanouk's resistance coalition, launched an equally harsh critique of Vietnam, whom they liken to the Nazis as well. But most political analysts here view a third nation, China, the real linchpin in the peace process, as a main military backer of the Khmer Rouge. And there's some speculation here, after an apparently positive meeting with U.S. Secretary of State James Baker today, that Western powers may be able to encourage China to cut its aid to the Khmer Rouge. But without naming the Khmer Rouge in his speech today, the Chinese foreign minister stated that Beijing would cease military assistance to the Cambodian parties only after the genuine and complete Vietnamese troop withdrawal under international supervision. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Paris.
A three-week-old dock strike in Britain fell apart today as more workers returned to their jobs after employers threatened to fire those who stayed away. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest, French hornist Barry Tuckwell, has been described as the finest French horn player of his generation and one of the finest horn players ever. That praise came from Winthrop Sargent in a 1977 New Yorker profile of Tuckwell. Barry Tuckwell was the first modern French hornist to sustain a career as a soloist. The Australian-born musician played in the London Symphony Orchestra for 13 years before embarking on a solo career in 1966. Now he has a dual career as a soloist and conductor. Tuckwell became the founding music director of the Maryland Symphony Orchestra. His guest conducting has taken him through Europe and the United States. A recent record features Tuckwell conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in performances of Wagner overtures. Barry Tuckwell, welcome to Fresh Air. You have a dual career now. I was wondering why you wanted to conduct when you first started conducting.
Well, I don't think of it as a dual career. I'm a musician, and I have two ways now that I express myself, as a player and as a conductor. But I don't think of them as separate existences.
Was starting to conduct a way of scaling back the performance end, the playing performance end?
No, I think that's like a negative approach. It's something that happened almost by chance. I wasn't actively looking to conduct. But when the occasion arose, I took the opportunity and felt that I had something to say. And it's developed from there.
You once called conducting the right arm disease.
If you sit in an orchestra, as I did for many wonderful years, you see from time to time somebody hopping up onto the box, determined to be a conductor at all costs. And, of course, nothing incurs the wrath of the players more than that, the upstart, pretentious person who thinks, ah, now I'm on the podium, I have all this power, when in fact you have zero power, because if you can't get the musicians to respond, it doesn't work. And how do you do it? Because you don't make a sound. And the conductor no longer can be tyrannical as they were 30, 40 years ago, where they had the power of almost life and death over the players. If you got the job, you could tell the players to do something, and if they didn't, they got the sack. That doesn't work anymore. You have to justify your position artistically.
You have to earn the respect of the players that you're conducting.
Oh, yes. And you have to remember that those players generally have probably been sitting in that orchestra for 25, 30 years. And this certainly applies to the young conductor. They're more experienced musically, quite often, than the conductor.
When you're doing a lot of freelance conducting, is it ever like being a substitute teacher where in the schools I went to, the substitute teacher was always tested when they came into the room. What can we get over this teacher? How much do they really know? And depending on how the teacher performed, the kids would either respect him or her or not. And they'd get a lesson taught or they wouldn't, depending on whether they got the respect. Is it ever that way when you're walking in the first time to a new symphony?
It's like that always with between the players and the conductor. There are sort of basic tricks and...
What kind of
sort
tricks?
Disobedience of not obeying an instruction, uh-huh. being told to play louder and you play softer or you... Whatever. I mean, there are subtle ways of doing it. You don't have to be blatant and downright rude about it. But certainly I've sat in the orchestra and I invented many tricks. You have your own technique.
Oh, tell me one.
Oh, no, they're copyright. I don't want anybody to play them back on me. I think this is fair game because if you sit in an orchestra, you will at some stage be a little bit bored and you'll think, I don't think that conductor knows what he's doing. And you test him. And you may test it in the way you play, how you play in the ensemble. And a good conductor spots that immediately. I mean, that's easy. What you have to, as a conductor, is decide whether the person is doing it unconsciously or consciously. If it's conscious, then it's a trick. And there are ways of dealing with it. It's part of the game. A good conductor... let me put it this way. When I was in the LSO, I never attempted to play tricks on Stokowski, Ormandy, Pierre Monteur, George Zell. You wouldn't get away with it. They were too good. They saw the trick coming.
Mm-hmm. But
they'd throw it back at you.
But a guest conductor you would?
Not just a guest conductor. It's on a conductor who is perhaps less than competent.
Mm-hmm. You once said that George Zell was the conductor who was cruelest to horn soloists.
He's certainly cruel to me.
What did he do?
Well, my first experience with him was recording the Handel Hearty Water Music Suite. And in that, there's a little section for muted horns, which would last 35, 40 seconds. We spent 40 to 50 minutes on that section. He took it apart. He got playing different note lengths, different dynamics. And I knew, because I'd heard of his reputation, that he was testing me, see how much I could take. And I decided I could take it all. But I think I still have the scars to show.
French horn soloist and conductor Barry Tuckwell is my guest. And I want to talk about your instrument and your musical performances. But first I want to play a little bit of a recent record of yours. And this is a record of Mozart horn concertos. We're going to hear an excerpt of the third movement, the rondo of his Horn Concerto No. 4 with my guest Barry Tuckwell, the French horn soloist. Barry Tuckwell, the French horn soloist, and Barry Tuckwell also conducting the English Chamber Orchestra. You were really the first French horn soloist, the first French horn player to have a career as a soloist. Why wasn't that done more often before?
Well, that's not strictly true, because there was a great horn soloist there were two great horn soloists in the latter part of the 18th century.
But, you know, if we're talking about violinists or pianists, cellists, we can all think of many soloists who have become very popular around the world. For French hornists, is really very few, and certainly of your generation, you were the first who really went off and succeeded in doing that. Why is it harder for a French hordist? Is it the repertoire?
There are many reasons. I think it's fashion. Also, one goes back historically. At the beginning of the 19th century, the whole nature of classical music changed. We went from the classical era through Beethoven into the Romantic era, into composers like Liszt and Wagner. And they wrote differently for the orchestra, particularly the brass instruments, which became mechanized. Valves were invented. And so wind instruments, woodwind and brass, became much more important within the orchestra.
When you were with the London Symphony Orchestra, and I think it was 13 years mm-hmm. that you were in the symphony, were there times when you were performing in a concert and there was very little work for the French horn to do in the repertory of the evening?
I don't ever remember having an easy concert. To me, just getting a sound out of the horn to do it responsibly and to do it beautifully is something that's always difficult.
But I ask this knowing that in some pieces, the French horn part is not necessarily a glorious one. And there are even some pieces, let's face it, where the tuba does the and the French horn does the pa-pa, right?
Well, there are certain pieces where you're probably not even aware of the horn. Mm-hmm. Let me think of a good example, I think, is the Beethoven Fourth Symphony, where you really don't hear the horns very much, and they don't play anything. They ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, and it's all very pretty. However, there's one note in the middle of the slow movement something like 12 measures rest, which is a nightmare for all horn players, because out of the blue, it's very quiet. He has to go... It's just those four notes. But, of course, if you don't get it cleanly, if you just play it a little bit later, or, worst of all, you just... Everybody hears and they say, oh, the horn player missed a note. And this is the nature of the instrument. There's probably one note in the whole concert which everybody will remember that you missed.
Now, I was thinking, too, though, that how exciting it must have been when you became a soloist to have more control over the repertoire and to find the pieces that you really wanted to play that would really show off the aspects of the instrument that you wanted.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I did leave the orchestra. I didn't decide I was sick of orchestral playing, because, in fact, I enjoyed it very much. We had a wonderful time. We played with the greatest conductors. But I felt that I was certainly probably able or capable of saying something a bit more musically than I could say while I was still in harness playing with the team, which you must do.
Mm-hmm.
And I did leave for that reason, and indeed I think it was right for me, although I have to say many times I do miss playing in the orchestra.
My guest is Barry Tuckwell, and he's one of the world's foremost French horn soloists and also now a conductor as well. We're going to talk more about his music after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
French hornist and conductor Barry Tuckwell is my guest. I think the French horn is a difficult instrument to get started on unless you're assigned it in the school band or something. It's an expensive instrument. Everybody gets a guitar or a piano when they're a kid if their parents are interested in having them play something. I can't think of parents who go out and buy their child a French horn when they're 8 years old. How did you come upon the French horn?
I grew up in a musical family, and my father was a professional pianist and organist. There was always music in the house. There was a piano in the house, which I liked to play, which I studied. I also studied the violin, and I also studied the organ. However, I knew that this was never going to be a way of life for me. I wasn't good enough at those instruments. And when I was 13, somebody handed me a French horn, and I took to it. It was, in fact, I was very lucky, it was something that I could play. And I could read music, and to my mind, at that time, I foolishly thought, this is much easier than the piano or the organ. There's only one note to play at a time, and generally they're much slower than the notes on other instruments, and, this is wonderful. I've been changing my mind a little bit more every day since then.
What makes a French horn such a challenging instrument to play?
Because there's nothing on it to make a sound. It's just a length of tubing. Same as trumpet or trombone, any of the brass instruments. The player actually has to vibrate the air inside with his lips. And you have many notes to choose from. You can aim for a note and you get another one. And in the case of the horn, it's perhaps less efficient than the other brass instruments due to the tapering of the tubing. It's a very long tube, and it starts off with a very, very narrow diameter and ends up with a very, very wide bell. But this produces a very beautiful sound. And if you improve the horn, I say physically improve it, it won't sound like a horn anymore. To have that beautiful sound, you have to play something that doesn't work very well.
When you say it doesn't sound like a horn when you play it well, what does it sound like?
Well, I'm thinking of an instrument which is a much better designed, in a sense, instrument like the trombone. Now, I don't mean the trombone's easy. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that at all. But it's a much more efficient piece of tubing. But if that sounds like a trombone. And if you want a trombone sound, you use that instrument. To get the particular quality of sound, which is... I don't know how to describe music. I don't think you can describe music. It's there or it isn't. But the horn has a particular sort of beautiful quality of sound of its own. And to get that, you have to play on an instrument that is basically unreliable.
The French horn being a brass instrument, as you blow into it, it accumulates a certain amount of spit. And with many French horns, what you have to do is kind of roll the instrument back and forth and then turn it over, and the spit comes out. Mm. And I know I played French horn briefly in my high school band, and the really embarrassing part of any performance that we had to do is when you had to clear the spit out of the instrument. How do you handle things like that?
Well, there's very little spit goes into the instrument.
Well, perhaps, not when I played it.
No, well, I'm just thinking that there's the first loop where obviously there must be some.
Yeah.
But basically what we're talking about is condensation. There's very warm, moist air which collects on the inside of the tube, and it collects several feet round, round many, many corners, and I can't spit that far. And it is a problem because on the horn, I think on my instrument, there are something like 13 or 14 places where this can collect.
Uh-huh.
If that happens to be on what we call a nodal point, because inside all these vibrations, it'll make a note virtually unmanageable. And you go, it's not the player's fault. The instrument just won't do it, so you have to get rid of it. That's why you do see the horn players searching desperately to find out where this is. This perhaps it's one little bead of condensation that's in the wrong place.
So do you, in the parts where you're not playing in a concert, have to go find that?
I have 1, 2, 3 little water keys, we call them, on spots where most of the condensation collects, and I just blow them, hoping that nobody will see what's happening, because I think it's distracting to see a soloist fooling around with his instrument, and you think, what's he? He's in trouble. He's in real trouble, and you see this shaking going on, and it detracts. So I prefer that the instrument should remain still during the bar's rest, where I'm, in fact, blowing the spit, as you call it, out of the horn.
Well, they are called spit valves, I don't know.
They are.
You're talking about how uncontrollable the instrument sometimes is. Have you ever played a concert where you noticeably missed a note?
Oh, I think everybody has, yes. Yes, I'm human.
Mm-hmm. So how do you... You just go on as if nothing's happened.
Oh, yes. You look.
Well, obviously, it's your only choice.
I when I play, I think of it a bit like driving, that you should be anticipating things going wrong. You should anticipate at every crossroad a car coming across or a child following a ball, all that sort of thing, or it's a corner that it might be icy, so that if something does happen, you're ready for it. And the same way that if you're playing, you know where hazards are. And if you approach it too fast or too loud or something, there's the possibility that it mightn't go quite right. And having anticipated, a minor slip doesn't become a major disaster area. So a good player anticipates and therefore covers potential disasters. Every performance has to be like that. See, if I went for note-perfect, safe performances, they wouldn't be interesting. I take it always to a danger area, so that I can say something more every performance. If it's a Mozart concerto, I'm often asked if I get bored playing the Mozart concertos. Well, I never get bored, A, because there's always something new to find out in the music. And also, every performance must be a development of the previous performances. And I'll always take something a little bit more, stretch it to the limit, a long phrase or a particular slur. But if I tried to keep it within the safety limits, the performances would be boring. And that is the secret of great performers, that you go away from the performance wondering what it was about it. Of course, if you could analyze it, it could be repeated, and therefore it wouldn't be a great performance. Everybody has some secret, perhaps unconscious secret, way of performing. And if you develop that and think about that, that is what makes an exciting performance.
Yeah, certainly. And you certainly don't walk away thinking, like, every note was accurate. I mean, it is not that that leaves you that wonderful feeling after you've heard a breathtaking concert.
To all instrumentalists, not just the French horn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think every instrument comes with its own obsessions. You know, with clarinets, it's the reed. What is it with the French horn that...
Lips, I think. We always blame everything on the embouchure.
Mm-hmm.
Incorrectly, quite a lot of the time. It might be just wrong breath support. Many things, just basic technique. But we always tend to think it's our lips first. I suppose that's because that's where we're most vulnerable.
Well, also you have to shape every note with your lips. I mean, there's only four vowels right on the French horn.
But you see, if you think of the lips like a string and the breath like the bow, you need both things. Because in a stringed instrument, it's how you use the bow, which for us is the breath. Same as a singer vibrates the vocal cords. We're vibrating the air inside an instrument. So the two things interact. To say one's more important than the other is like the chicken and the egg.
The teeth really affect the embouchure. Do you have like a very... Is your dentist your most special doctor?
Oh, indeed. I go to a very special dentist who, in fact, is a horn player in Jacksonville, Florida, and quite a lot of horn players go to him because he understands our problems and what we have to take care of. And he speaks to me very fiercely sometimes that my gums aren't as good as they should be and I should take more vitamin C and floss more and things like that, because we do have to be careful. It's not basically teeth, it's the gums. If the gums get weak, the teeth move, and then that's curtains.
Mm-hmm. You once pointed out that there's showmanship that goes with certain instruments. With the violinist, you see the arms moving as the violinist bows. And with the piano, you also see the arms moving and the head moving away. The French horn, playing a French horn is a very still occupation, yep. I think. There's very little physical visible showmanship involved with it.
You can't show off as you can on, I'd say, every other instrument. You certainly can on stringed instruments and the piano. And you certainly can on woodwind instruments. You can do it on the clarinet. You can wail around. You can do it on a trumpet and a trombone because they're, more symmetrical with the body. The horn comes round the wrong way and it's too heavy on one side. And if you start doing that, you miss notes. And I have noticed some colleagues who tend to, I think, show off more than is acceptable. Just for visual effect. But when it's difficult, they keep very still. I used to say that to colleagues in the orchestra. Well, why don't you move around in that phrase as much as you did in the phrase before? You know, turning the knife, cruel. Because I suppose we feel a bit frustrated playing the horn. You can't sort of jump around to the same extent.
Barry Tuckwell now has a dual career as French hornist and conductor. He's also the music director of the Maryland Symphony Orchestra. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is from Barry Tuckwell's recent recording of Mozart Horn Concertos.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to Frank Zappa from his Hot Rats album. The composer and rock satirist has a new memoir, and book critic John Leonard has a review. Also coming up, veteran journalist Otto Friedrich gives us a lesson from the old days on how to cover a war without getting within 1,000 miles of it. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue by saxophonist Albert Eiler. Kevin says Eiler had one of the most loved and hated sounds of the 1960s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. It still hasn't been confirmed that Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins was hanged today by members of a pro-Iranian group. Higgins' wife viewed the videotape, but she wasn't able to confirm that the man was Higgins. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says after meeting with national security advisors late this afternoon, President Bush received a briefing on the status of the situation. Earlier today, the president called Higgins' apparent execution an outrage that shocks all Americans. Bush cut short a cross-country trip and returned to Washington this afternoon. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Officials say no decisions will be made in response to the kidnappers' actions until there is final confirmation of Colonel Higgins' death. A senior administration official speaking on the condition of anonymity told NPR there is little doubt it's Higgins' body on the videotape. The question is, when did he die? There had been several reports earlier of Higgins' death, and it's possible the videotaped hanging was faked. But the senior official said there is evidence this was, quote, a fresh kill. Officials say the president has several options to consider and that plans for dealing with this kind of situation have been in the works for months. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said this evening's meeting in the cabinet room is not meant to engender any sense of drama, but he also reiterated that the U.S. had warned that the hostage takers would be held accountable for their actions. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
There's been no official reaction from Iran over the apparent murder of Higgins. Earlier today, Iran's foreign minister said Iran condemned threats against innocent people. An Iranian official has given mixed signals to pro-Iranian groups in Lebanon, as NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Iran's foreign minister, Ali Akbar Velayati, called the kidnapping of three Lebanese, including a Muslim cleric, state terrorism, but stopped far short of supporting the death threats against Colonel Higgins. But in a news conference yesterday, Iran's interior minister, Ali Akbar Motashami, took a harder position, saying that Islamic groups in Lebanon were justified in taking action against the U.S. and Israel. Motashami is the godfather of the radical Islamic group Hezbollah. He was Iran's ambassador in Lebanon for years. In the past month, various Lebanese groups have visited Tehran, including Hezbollah. According to press reports here, the meetings were to coordinate their strategies against Israel. The U.S. administration has said in the past it holds Iran responsible for hostages in Lebanon. It's likely that Washington will focus on Montashami's statements rather than the words of the foreign minister. In Tehran, this is Deborah Amos.
The U.S. Army was called out today to help battle fires raging out of control on thousands of acres in the West. National Guardsmen already are on duty in Idaho and Oregon. Officials say hundreds of fires, most started by lightning last week, have blackened more than 100,000 acres in 5 states since Wednesday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 25 points today. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. During the free jazz movement of the 1960s, tenor saxophonist Albert Eiler had one of the best-loved and most hated sounds in music. Some listeners found his playing deeply spiritual, the musical equivalent of speaking in tongues. Others thought it was just noise. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead loves Eiler's music, but says such contradictory reactions are fitting because Eiler's style is a paradox, both beautiful and grotesque. Kevin has a review of a new reissue of some music Eiler recorded shortly before his death in 1971.
In some ways, saxophonist Albert Eiler was the most radical of jazz musicians. His coarsely energetic playing epitomized the free jazz of the 1960s. But in many ways, his radical approach marked a return to jazz's earliest days and to music even earlier than that. For one thing, Eiler used a wide vibrato that had been out of fashion for four decades. It reminded a lot of critics of the first great jazz saxophonist, Sidney Bechet. The album Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village, just reissued on CD by Impulse, is drawn from two live dates with slightly different bands from 1966 and 67. Both groups had his brother Donald Eiler on trumpet, and both were heavy with strings, violin, cello, and two basses. But no jazz musician has used a string section with less high culture pretensions than Albert Eiler. Instead of using strings to enrich or gussy up his music's harmonies, Eiler turned them loose, as he turned every instrument loose, to freely interpret his simple themes. His melodies and chord structures were just about the simplest jazz had ever seen, as elemental as the blues, though they didn't sound like blues. Eiler's tunes suggest military fanfares, fundamentalist hymns, European folk dances, and the sentimentality of Stephen Foster. Here's Albert Eiler's Truth is Marching In. The collectively improvised sound of Eiler's units got very complex, but his method was elementary. Take a simple tune and depart from it in any way taste or instinct dictate, forging a new sound out of creative paraphrasing and your resources as an instrumentalist. That's how jazz got started in southern brass bands back around 1900. So the great revolutionary Albert Eiler was also a great conservative. He understood jazz's boundless ability to renew itself out of its own past. But he also understood that renewal would be meaningless if his music didn't sound fresh. No problem. Nobody's music had ever sounded like Albert Eiler's, and though some have tried to imitate his style and his sing-song melodies, no one has sounded like him since either. The latest batch of reissues from Impulse is most impressive. It also includes fine albums by saxophonists Gatto Barbieri and Sam Rivers, and great large ensemble dates from bassists Charlie Hayden and Charles Mingus. And I like the fact that the Eiler CD reproduces the original psychedelic packaging. So I hate the carp. But at 37 minutes, the Eiler set is pretty short. CDs can hold 80 minutes of music, and Impulse released a double album of additional stuff from these concerts in the 1970s. It would have made sense to tack some of that music onto this set. Still, Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village is the only one of Eiler's many Impulse records currently available, and a little is a lot better than nothing.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Albert Eiler in Greenwich Village. It's on the Impulse label. This is Fresh Air. Early on in his nearly 40-year career as a journalist, Otto Friedrich learned how to cover a war without getting near the country it was being fought in. Friedrich was working for an American wire service and was based in Paris in 1953 when he filed stories about the French war in Indochina. In 1959, he wrote an article called How to Be a War Correspondent, and he says the article was motivated by his sense of guilt. The article is included in his new collection of essays, The Grave of Alice B. Toklas and Other Reports from the Past. Friedrich is also the author of City of Nets, a book about Hollywood in the 1940s, and a biography of Canadian pianist Glenn Gould. Since 1971, Friedrich has written for Time magazine. I asked him to describe the reporting he now feels so guilty about, covering Vietnam from France.
The French army periodically issued bulletins on what was going on in Vietnam, and these were officially announced. So that was the major source of information, whether they were announced in Paris or in Vietnam. The cheapest way to get this information was to have the Paris Bureau report it. And, of course, we dressed it up a bit by, you know, made it more exciting.
Like how?
Well, you know, the French army communiqués were sort of uninformative. And it's not just uninformative, they were bland. And the AP would always say, you know, the French army announced today that. We would say, combat infantry men of such and such a regiment in battle, full battle dress, splashed ashore today, and freeway landings, that sort of thing. And this is what got printed.
Yeah, well, you say that your editors always wanted you to write with enthusiasm.
Yeah. Well, that was the term for that kind of writing.
Mm-hmm. Action verbs.
Yeah. and generally a sense of excitement, just as though you were there, when, of course, you weren't there.
Mm-hmm. You also say that there was a pressure to write almost fiction from two ends, pressure from the military, but also pressure from your editors. Would you explain that pressure on both ends to kind of dress up and almost fictionalize the stories you were writing?
Well, you have to remember that by pressure from the government, I mean the French government was constantly looking to America for financing for its war, and so they wanted to convey the impression that they were doing big things in Indochina, and they just needed a little more help all the time. When I say editors, remember that I don't mean my own editors so much as the editors of newspapers, who just get this stuff coming in. They don't know where it's coming from, and they just, you know, pick the most exciting story. So, if your story is consistently the more exciting one, that's what's going to get printed.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any pressure for political slant from your editors?
No. Quite the opposite. They didn't want any politics. This was purely a war story. It was a French war story, so we didn't really care what it was all about. It was just, you know, it was a shoot 'em up kind of story. Nobody had paid any attention to Vietnam while the Korean War was going on. And after the Korean War ended, editors sort of felt a nostalgia for the good old daily war story. So all of a sudden they became more interested in Vietnam. And it was purely a shoot 'em up war, as it was in the early days of the American involvement. You know, the Americans would announce how many casualties they inflicted today, and that was the story, at least if the American government had its way.
You're making it sound like very, very phony news coverage. How did you live with it if you felt that it was so deceitful?
Well, it is phony. You live with it because that's what you did for a living. They would tell you, you know, you're working here and you're writing stories not only about that, but about everything that happens in Paris. And and in the whole French Union, for that matter. The French then controlled much of the world, and here we were, one guy next to an AFP ticker is responsible for converting what comes in on the AFP ticker. That's Agence France-Presse, the French national news agency. We're in effect a glorified translation of that and jazzing it up to make it sound like an American story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not... It doesn't pose that much of a crisis of conscience, you know, if you're, at least in the old days, you did what you were told because you had to. That's how you got a job, and that's how you kept a job.
From 1957 to 1962, you left Newsweek. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years after you left in 1964, you wrote an article for Harper's Magazine
about
how for Newsweek you had to file stories, that reporters always seem to file stories with a lot of pretty pointless facts, and that there was a corresponding editorial fetish for accuracy in absurd facts. What's an example of a pointless fact?
Well, they're not pointless. They're not pointless. They have a very definite point. The definite point is to convey an impression that the writer or reporter in this story is absolutely the supreme authority on every aspect of that story, that he knows whatever it is, the color of the man's eyes, how old he is, what he wears, and his kind of underwear he wears, what he eats for breakfast, all that kind of essential trivia is put in to convey this impression of absolute authoritativeness. And that, implies that any political judgments that are being made are equally authoritative. We really know what we're talking about.
We found that, it's very common for reporters to not really know the specifics of the fact they were using. The example you use in your title is that there are 00 trees in Russia, and it would be the fact-checker's job to find out exactly how many trees are in Russia. And the reporter would just leave it blank. What was that practice called?
I don't think it had a name, actually.
Oh, okay.
But let me clarify something. It was not the reporters who did this. It was the writers and editors. The essential, and I should also explain, this has changed somewhat to give more authority to the reporters now than they had then. The essential system then was that the reporter filed everything he knew to New York, where a writer took it and combined it with anything else he was found interesting, whether it was a clipping from the New York Times or some government report or all available sources were used along with the reporter's report to create the most interesting and authoritative article that you could. And often, if there was some fact that you wanted to illustrate some point, and you didn't know what the exact fact was, or it wasn't in the reporter's file, you just left a 00. It's a kind of fact that is wanted. The specific fact is left up to the fact checker.
What's wrong with that?
Well, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with it. except when you get these weird, when it's done wrong in some weird way. Like, my classic story is about the Sudanese army, which was told me by a fact checker, and she couldn't find out what the number of the editor had written in the 00 man Sudanese army, and she couldn't find the number, and she called the Sudanese embassy, and they couldn't tell her what it was. And finally, the editor told her to make an educated guess, which is what people did as you got nearer to deadline. So she said there was a 17,000-man Sudanese army, and this duly got printed, and then the Sudanese embassy would sort of make cull stories from the American press that dealt with Sudan. That would be sent back to Khartoum, and then the Khartoum press would say, print stories saying, here's what they are saying about us in America. And so they printed this story saying there was a 17,000-man Sudanese army. And then that duly went back to New York, to Washington, as an example of the summary of the Khartoum press for this week. And this guy, same guy at the Sudanese embassy, called up this woman about, you know, a month later and said, oh, now I can finally tell you the number of men there are in the Sudanese army. Exactly 17,000. He was so pleased. And she thought it was just, you know, this was the sort of a parody of the whole system.
You've worked both at Time and at Newsweek. You've mm-hmm. been at Newsweeklies a long time, so I think you'll be able to answer this question. What's the logic behind separating the two tasks of reporting and writing? For instance, frequently in the news magazines, you'll see that the article is written by one person, but it's reported by a different person.
Mm-hmm. Again, I should preface this by saying that there are many people who have that same problem, and the tendency now is to have more and more reporters write their own stories, or vice versa, have writers go out and report their own stories. I'm probably old-fashioned. I don't like this technique. I like the technique of separating them. The main reason why it's done is that it gives the writer an enormous flexibility about what to get from where. I mean, many stories, particularly news magazine stories, involve material that comes from all kinds of places, Moscow, Washington, Beirut, whatever. If you want to do a story on the, you know, the state of opera in America, you might want to file from New York and a file from Boston and a file from Houston. And you'd have all these different correspondents filing into you, you see, and you'd put it all together. If you have one reporter writing his own story, he either got to have a story only from one place, i.e. there's a murder in Denver, or you got to send him around from place to place, which takes months. Whereas the standard news magazine technique can put together a very complicated story. Let's say there's the change of government in Russia, and you might want a story from China. You want information from China, from Washington, wherever. You might also want a lot of history about past changes in Russia, which you could get best in New York from your library. And so it enables the news magazine editors, and that's the key thing about news magazines, is that they're heavily edited magazines. Enables the editor to put together a complicated story from a lot of different places in very fast time, which you just can't do by having the reporters do it themselves.
No, I always assumed that the real reason behind that separation of functions was to have a reporter who can write in the house style, so to speak. You know, who can write in that in the style that Newsweek calls its own or Time calls its own.
That that used to be true to some extent, but it's changed to some extent in that news magazine copy isn't as different as it used to be from what appears in a newspaper or any other kind of media. But there's also a question of can a reporter write at all? You know, I mean, when I was at the Daily News, there were plenty of police reporters who'd never written a story in their lives. Their function was to know what was going on in the police station and on the police beat. They weren't supposed to know how to write, and they would telephone in whatever they had, and the rewrite man on the desk would take it down, and he would write the story. He's supposed to know how to write. I still think that's true to some extent. I mean, I think that you now now that you have more reporters writing their own stories, you have people who are wonderful reporters and not terrific writers having to write stories because that's the way it's done now, and they're often not as well written as they could be if a really good writer were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, a lot of writers like me, I mean, I hate to do reporting, so and I'm a very good writer. If you send me out to do reporting, you won't get as good reporting as you will from some guy who is really good at it.
What's kept you at Newsweeklies for so long?
Well, it's fairly pleasant work. They pay very well, and I know how to do it well. So these things all tend to work to make the job rather pleasant.
Otto Friedrich, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Otto Friedrich's new collection of essays, The Grave of Alice B. Toklas and Other Reports from the Past, is published by Henry Holt. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins was murdered today by his kidnappers. How are you covering that?
Well, we're trying to deal with the story itself and what ramifications there may be, reactions from Israel, from other parts of the Middle East, and we will, of course, be watching to see what President Bush says that he is going to do or we ought to do. We're also hearing reports from all over the region that other hostages being held in the Middle East may also be in danger, so we'll be following that story today.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Frank Zappa has been hailed by some as a rock genius. Others find his music offensive, but some of his detractors find him merely adolescent and self-indulgent. Over the past few years, Zappa has taken on another public role as an opponent of those who would like to censor explicit rock lyrics, including his own. Now Zappa's written a book about his life and how he sees the world. Book critic John Leonard has this review of the real Frank Zappa book.
Reading Frank Zappa is more fun than listening to him. I say this as somebody decidedly unhip, a print freak, a book chick. Listening to Zappa, who almost from the beginning in L.A. did weird things to mix up doo-wop with 12-tone, rhythm and blues and Stravinsky, has always been a pain in the ear because what I couldn't hear were his words, the political satire and the antisocial comment, the theater and anthropology and mordant meditations on brown shoes and brain police. I had to read his album notes. Now I can read his autobiography instead, an amazing document. Who would have guessed that his father was into ballistics missiles and poison gas? That his mother was a nice Catholic who liked to watch roller derby? That Lenny Bruce refused to autograph Zappa's draft card? That Mick Jagger removed a splinter from his foot while they discussed European history? That this very same Zappa, one of the heroes of the 60s counterculture, refused from the get-go to do drugs? It turns out that he has always disdained what he calls chemical refreshment and consciousness-altering entertainment products. He despises cocaine-tweezed rug munchers. When he smokes, it's cigarettes. To me, he says, a cigarette is food. His exclusive brew is black water, lots of coffee. He has a theory about beer. Quote, consumption of it leads to military behavior. One day you're going to read about some scientist discovering that hops, in conjunction with certain strains of yeast creatures, has a mysterious effect on some newly discovered region of the brain, making people want to kill, but only in groups. With whiskey, you might want to murder your girlfriend, but beer makes you want to do it with your buddies watching. Zappa has theories on everything, from the bassoon, it has a medieval aroma, to the end of the world. It isn't necessary to imagine the world ending in fire or ice. There are two other possibilities. One is paperwork, the other is nostalgia. About women and AIDS and former Surgeon General Koop, the real Frank Zappa book is irresponsible and maybe even dangerous. On almost everything else, including Tipper Gore and the porn sniffers, it's hilarious. About yuppies, for instance, white bred mutants who set out to breed that one perfect little child artifact piece of furniture combination snack pack. About orchestras, viola players are failed violinists. This happens in grade school. People who can't quite cut it in the violin section get banished to viola land. Flute players and harpists look to me like they have a bad attitude because of all that cloud and angel music they have to play. Or on how to make American democracy safe from Islamic terrorists, aerosol pork grenades. Only on the music that I can't listen to is Zappa entirely serious, and then he's often surprisingly eloquent. I ended up believing him. Quote, information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Wisdom is not truth. Truth is not beauty. Beauty is not love. Love is not music. Music is the best. I don't know what else to tell you about this unicorn of a book. Imagine, if you dare, Hunter S. Thompson and Fats Domino and Ninja Turtles.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Real Frank Zappa book. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Vlaidis, Thad Kirk, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
What will you do if we let you go? And the plastics all melted, and so is the chrome. Who are the brain police?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, trumpeter Buck Clayton remembers playing with the Basie Band back in the 30s and tells us about the band he's been leading now that he can no longer play. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles one of the pioneers of rock and roll, Gene Vincent. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.